I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News Professor Francis Campbell. Welcome, Francis.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you.
Francis, as all Fremantle people listening to this podcast will know, but if they don't, I should make very clear, Francis is the Vice Chancellor of Notre Dame, as we colloquially refer to it here in the Port City. Francis, when did you take up this position?
February the 6th, 2020.
Oh, golly, about a fortnight or a month or so before the pandemic hit us.
That is correct. That is correct. I first heard of the pandemic in late January, and I was wrapping up to go. And at that stage, it was something that was emerging sort of more out of China. We met some colleagues here from Fremantle. We were at a conference together in Washington that happens every year for Catholic universities. And they said to me, how are you getting to Perth? And I said, I'm coming via Hong Kong. And they said, no, don't go via Hong Kong. There's a thing called COVID. You need to come direct. Otherwise, you could end up, at that stage, I think the government was suggesting that people would have to go to Christmas Island for detention. So I quickly changed my ticket and came direct from London to Perth on the direct Qantas flight. And it just was a different world in the 48 hours before, so nothing before, and then all of a sudden, I think three or four emails from the Australian government, text messages from Qantas, and you could just see things beginning to ramp up, and that was just the first days of February 2020.
We'll all have our recollections. In my case, where I was when I heard that JFK had been shot, but in more recent times, we'll all recall where we were when the pandemic seemed to break out most.
Yes.
Just flown across from an important meeting in Sydney and got back, but Sydney was virtually deserted. And this was before it officially was declared.
That's right. I remember I went over to Sydney and we were to do three installation ceremonies for the Vice Chancellor. So we were to do the first in Sydney, the second in Perth, and the third in Broome. We only got doing one. It was all being organised around the Archbishop's calendars, and I remember then being in Sydney for the St. Patrick's Day Mass in the Cathedral, and that was the 17th of March, and I think lockdown came on the 19th, and I think I travelled on the evening of the 17th back to Perth.
Well, so much has happened since then, but well, belatedly, welcome to Australia.
Thank you, Michael.
Even more importantly, welcome to Fremantle.
Thank you.
As if I've got some right to welcome people here. But what did you know about Australia, Perth, Fremantle before you arrived then?
So I had come to Fremantle for the first time in late 2018 as part of the interview process, and just to get to know the university. And when I arrived here, I'd been to Australia twice before, once in 2008 when Pope Benedict had come for World Youth Day into Sydney, and then in 2015 for an education conference in Melbourne. But I'd never been to the West. And when I came to Fremantle, in fact, I was waiting just outside where we are now in the old customs house. I came out of Perth a little bit early, sort of, you know, you look around. And I remember sort of just looking at something and finding on the on one of these sort of ancestry sites the arrival record of my great-grandfather to Australia in 1908, and he came through Fremantle. And in fact, he settled in Western Australia, and I subsequently, in 2020, found his grave in Karaketa.
How touching is that?
So it was, I remember telling my father at the time, you know, back on Zoom, because we weren't able to meet. But I remember telling him, and his eyes were agog, because this was, you know, sort of news of someone he had never known. But this was actually the arrival point, and then being in and around Western Australia and registered in different sort of sites, you know, with the census, etc. So that was the first connection to Fremantle. We would never have known, you know, you would have heard of Fremantle. We'd heard, in fact, this month in 1822 was the first family connection to Australia, but that was around deportation. And that was, again, that was into At the time, sort of the way this is handed down, I remember, you know, my grandmother would always talk about Van Diemen's Land, and I associated Van Diemen's Land with Tasmania. So I thought, oh, he must have gone, must have been sent to Tasmania, but the records actually show they were sent to New South Wales, they were sent to Sydney, actually, and they arrived in October 1822. But again, they had been sentenced in the spring of 1820. But again, you know, when you look into the records, which are really, you know, curated very well in Australia, what they used to do is they used to take them and they used to hold them on an island off Cork. And then they would deport from there once they had significant numbers. So that's in terms of family connections, and then there's other family connections that you see, you know, again through ancestry, around the middle of the 19th century, around the famine, and that's coming from sort of the Galway side of my family, where my mother was from Galway and my father was from County Down. So it's two different strands coming into Australia in two different directions.
It's fascinating, isn't it? I think even today, but certainly when I was growing up, my sense was that of European Australians, about one half of them had an Irish side, as I did with my Mena family, yes, coming from Belfast way, but other parts of the family coming from nearer to Cork, as you've mentioned. But there are these other wonderful Irish connections in Fremantle. Just a week ago, we had the John Boyle O'Reilly Wild Goose Lecture, celebrating the Fenians who arrived on the last convict ship in 1868. Not long ago, really.
No. By Irish history standards, indeed, not long ago. But it's, yes, the and again, you know, when you come here with the escape from Fremantle and the Fenian connection to Fremantle and the history, and again, you know, rediscovering that, because I think that is not something, I had not connected Fremantle to that. And I think, again, most of the, as we approach certain anniversaries, the history of that, and how we've spoken to the Irish ambassador about how we might do more with regards to remembering that and raising it, the profile at home.
Yeah, it really is, in a sense, a wonderful history. It reminds West Australians that they are connected with the rest of the world.
Yes,
you can get an Irish whaler in here without any trouble in the
late
19th
yes.
century and whisk people off to Boston.
Yes.
But you've mentioned your mother from County Galway,
yes,
father from County Down, the latter in the Republic, and sorry, the other way around, Galway
in the south,
in
yes,
the south, and Down in the north. And where were you brought up?
I was brought up in Northern Ireland, just inside the border, on what we would describe as the southern border of Northern Ireland, right halfway, roughly about 35 miles south of Belfast, about 65 miles north of Dublin, but just on, as the crow would fly, about 7 miles to the border.
Now, you're a little younger than me, but as I read the period of the Troubles, it went on for a damn long time, Francis, and you grew up through some of that period. When you were growing up, and I gather on a farm, did Dublin and Belfast each play a role in your life?
Yes, it. You look back now and you realise probably how abnormal that period was, but when you're living through it, and when you have known nothing else, that is normal. That is what normality is. And my mother and father had met in London. My father had gone to Canada. He'd been working in Canada for quite some time in his youth. He then returned, he came back to London. He met my mother in London. They married, they moved home. And that's where they decided to raise their family. And that was 1964. And then the Troubles really started from the 1969. I was born 1970. And it was, you know, it depended on where you were in relation to within Northern Ireland at that time. But we would have, because I had a lot of relatives across the border, we would have traveled across the border quite a bit. But very few of our relations or our cousins would come north. So you would always have to go south. My father then left. We were to migrate. My mother wanted to leave. So we were planning to emigrate to Canada in the early 70s. And we didn't. And my father was there working, and he would come back every so often. But we decided to stay. And it really lasted the whole way through to the mid-1990s. And I remember as a student, I was in Belgium, and a bit, you know, like what you said with regards to where you are when John F. Kennedy was assassinated. I can remember when somebody told me in the library in Leuven that there had been a loyalist ceasefire, so a ceasefire on the loyalist side in 1994. And it was an Irish person who told me this, who had spent most of his life in South Africa. And I think he had worked in South Africa for 35 or 36 years. And he said to me, have you heard? He heard my accent, and he just said, have you heard the news? And I remember standing there and not quite being able to comprehend that this change had occurred, because my view up to that point was that this was always so and always would be so and could never change.
Well, it just tells you so many things, doesn't it, about living, about ideology, about things that you're taught were always so and are fixed in your mind, and change suddenly happens. Berlin walls collapse. Imelda Marcos has to give up her shoes. Apartheid in South Africa. And yet the world never changes. We're battling over the Ukraine. Got a wonderfully powerful China dominating in other ways around the world. And you, Francis, in 2005 were appointed by the British government to be the ambassador to the Holy See in Vatican. Congratulations.
Yes, that happened. Things changed, and things, I think in that period, you know, growing up and looking, you know, I always think of later in life when I worked with the British government, and we were looking at issues around decommissioning of weapons and demilitarization on the border. And these discussions were taking place in the late 1990s. And I remember from a little over 10 years before seeing those towers being built even higher on the border from my school window. So you know, sometimes to sort of walk that space, or to walk in that space from, you know, what was quite a militarized border, and to get across it was quite, you know, the queues would have been quite extensive. But actually, if you were local, you knew which back roads to take.
You knew which road to take.
They were called unapproved roads, and the army kept destroying them, and then the farmers would reconnect them overnight. So you sort of, you look back and you think it was a surreal time. But there was a window of opportunity that occurred where there was a constellation of political leadership on all sides at that time that just created or took advantage of the right circumstances for change. And so much of peacemaking is about individuals and timing and just a level of trust and courage. And I think the relationship between London and Dublin at that time, I think it was a high water mark. I think Brexit has, you know, diminished some of that, a lot of it actually. But I think the leadership, the courage, the ability to move forward, and I just think that opened up just a different horizon, that up to that point, it was either or, that your identity, if you were in a Northern Ireland context, political and religious identity conflated. And you had very much parallel societies and parallel communities. And the representation of Irishness that you found in Northern Ireland wasn't always what you saw in the South, and ditto on the British side. That, you know, and yet both, or the communities within Northern Ireland, often had more in common with each other than they had with respective populations in other parts of either Britain or Ireland.
One would like to think that's true of humanity generally when they just scratch themselves for a moment or two. I was brought up in Australia as an Australian with this sort of half Irish, half English immigrant background. On the Irish side, I was probably brought up as though I were a Athenian. Couldn't understand for a minute how the island of Ireland could be partitioned, in a sense, in the way it was and is. And I read around the topic, and politics is a fluctuating thing. You talked about the famine in Ireland in the mid-19th century. Lots of people left. No doubt it marked a lot of people's views of the world at that stage. I do wonder whether Ireland's not in a situation now where in the next however many years it doesn't become one country. Is that a dangerous topic to raise with you?
No, it's not a dangerous topic because it's a live topic. It's not a topic that I thought in my lifetime would be realistically discussed, but Brexit and the fallout from Brexit has brought stuff onto the table that, you know, just forces a debate. And I think, you know, the exit from the European Union has been really traumatic for Northern Ireland because I started out life more in politics in the Social Democratic and Labour Party, and one of the founders of that party was John Hume, who was the person who took the first steps in the peace process by starting the dialogue with Sinn Féin and Gerry Adams and linking back and forward to the British government and into the US government at the time. And he understood, he was a member of the European Parliament, he was also a member of the Westminster Parliament, but he was very taken by the reconciliation between France and Germany, very taken by the reconciliation at the heart of the European project. And membership, the combined membership of the UK and Ireland in the European Union, meant that the economic and trade border was irrelevant. So the only thing keeping the border was the security side. And his whole thing was, you know, to learn and to see how the two countries had moved. So all of a sudden, London and Dublin had other things to talk about in the context of the European Union that brought them together. And there is a lot of politicians on both the Irish and the British side that talk about the growing contacts between the respective governments and civil servants and the positive spillover that then occurred into a building up of trust vis-a-vis the Northern Ireland peace process. They knew each other, but they knew each other through less contentious points. Brexit, one of the casualties of Brexit has been Northern Ireland because it has sort of pulled again back to binary identities. So you had a situation where you know, under the Good Friday Agreement, which is the agreement from 1998 that solidifies the peace process, you can be British, you can be Irish, or you can be both. But under all that umbrella is you were a common European citizen. And all of a sudden, this is sort of being torn again. And I think we have yet to find a way, one of the key contentious issues in Britain's break from the European Union remains the Northern Ireland Protocol. Because either, you know, and John Major, the former British Prime Minister, along with Tony Blair, they went as part of the referendum campaign arguing against Brexit, they tried to say, this will seriously undermine the peace process. And they were, you know, laughed at, that they were alarmist. But actually we're now left with a conundrum. You either have some form of trade border in the Irish Sea, or you reintroduce some sort of trade border on land. And I think that there does create, it shakes things. And now you have some people who say, look, the premise on which this agreement was raised, the premise of, you know, dismantling borders and boundaries, that actually this hastens the debate around having a referendum on unification, which is one of the promises in the peace agreement, when it looks as if there is likely to be a majority in favour. But this is still a highly divided society. So you will still end up with a degree of alienation in a substantial part of the population. And therefore, you know, the view of the Irish government is that this is not something that must happen imminently. This takes a huge amount of time, and you have to bring a significant number of people with you.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see how it develops. Francis, as a young man leaving school, did you have a dream about what it was you wanted to do? Did you have a particular calling at that point? I have a sense from what I do understand that you headed off to Queen's University.
That's right.
You might even have been thinking about the priesthood at one point.
Well, I did. I had two loves in my life as a teenager, but I didn't know. One of them, I didn't know why, really. One love was politics.
Ah.
And I became politically active at a quite a young age with what was then the party that represented the largest number of the Catholic population, the Social Democratic and Labour Party. And I also, I became and was always very active in and around parish life and the church. And the Catholic Church, for me growing up, it was a place where automatically inside its confines, you were not second class. The rest of the system, I felt very strongly alienated from. And I think that would have been an experience shared by a lot of Catholics of my age and older. Whereas in the school system and in the church, you didn't feel in any sense, you felt safe, and you felt that this fundamentally was a place of refuge. So I always think back to that period, and you know, it provided very much a very strong moral compass, which I will be forever grateful for. Because sometimes in a conflict type situation, and there is always an emotional allure to simplistic solutions for complex problems. And you know, they talk about the hot-headedness of youth, that I look back and I think, especially of my mother, and I think there were four of us growing up in an environment where it would be very easy for some of us to have drifted onto a different political path, which some others did. And I think those were cases of people often being in the wrong place at the wrong time and accidents of history. So that framework for me, so I thought when I was growing up, I initially had the desire that I wanted to be a priest, and I actually did enter seminary and went to a seminary in Belfast, and also at the same time studied at the university in Belfast as well, which is a secular public university.
When you said you were politically active at a young age, is it right to think that you wanted to change the world? Were there some particular things that were really motivating you then? Looking back.
Yeah, it's only later in life, when I was probably in my 20s, and when I got out of Northern Ireland and started with studying abroad, that I realised that at the root of my interest was an interest in religion and an interest in politics. And at that time, that didn't seem odd to me. But when I stepped out clearly what I was doing was I was trying to make sense of the world in which I was living in. And, you know, that period and that time, just the framework, what was it I was interested in politics? I suppose I took from my mother a tremendous sense of human dignity. She was Southern Irish living in Northern Ireland. If you were a Northerner, you could open your mouth, people wouldn't know what religion you were. You could blend in. When she would open with her accent, they'd immediately know. And you just look and, you know, the horror of what is, you know, divisions in society or sectarianism or any type of division, which basically pits one group of people against another group of people, or where one person contemplates doing violence towards another on the basis of a difference. It's, you know, when that's programmed into the society, when people are so divided, it's a frightening scenario to be in. And the political party that I became attracted to was a party that responded on a number of fronts, but it responded peacefully, not with violence, towards the injustice of the state. So it was founded as a successor to the civil rights movement, which campaigned for end to discrimination in housing, end to discrimination in employment, and end to discrimination in society. But its method was via democratic and peaceful means. And that stood in contrast to those that took a violent path. But to those, it condemned violence without any hesitation or qualification. But it also condemned violence from the state. And sometimes I look back and I see, you know, if I look at the 16-year-old self, and if I look at the 26-year-old self, or the future self, you know, representing a country or a government, that period in time growing up, it wasn't a place where I felt refuge or felt safety. It was a place where this government or this state didn't protect my interests, and I would have been viewed with suspicion and disdain on the basis of background or birth. But that was then, and I've thought, you know, the first 25 years of my life has been very different to the next 25 years.
Well, just after the 26-year-old self, you find yourself working in the British government, do you not? A position as a young man with his politics and graduate background, working in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office.
Yes.
How did that come about, Francis? Was it by accident, or did you apply for a job? Did they want some Catholic Northern Irishman who still had a nice accent? What happened then?
No, they applied. I remember in university, I remember asking a few. I liked politics, I liked international relations, I liked foreign policy. I like researching and studying on Irish politics, but I came to the conclusion on Irish politics that I wasn't impartial enough to be able to do serious research, that I couldn't see the wood from the trees. And so I got more interested in the whole aspect of European integration, and I suppose that segued from the Irish into the European. But I remember at university, you know, the notion was that if you were from this community, you would, if you wanted to work in foreign policy, you would work in London, and if you were from that community, you would work in Dublin. And I've never sort of tended to take those instructions easily, because I thought, well, actually, if this is the United Kingdom, I liked London. I had been going to London as a teenager to work for the summer, and I used to work every summer. And my mother had loved London, and she had lived in it. I had some family in London originally born in Ireland and had lived there. And my older brother had been there as well. So I went and I stayed there, and I suppose in a sense, the younger self through school and university, this had sort of I began to make a distinction between what it meant to be British in a London context and what it meant to be British in a Northern Ireland context. And I could see the separation or the difference, which was never clear or visible to me at home, because in both contexts of identity in Northern Ireland, you can very easily fit into something where it is exaggerated. So you can have an exaggerated Irish identity or an exaggerated British identity. And in London, the British identity was manifesting itself quite differently. But I applied for the Fast Stream, which is an entry point for the civil service for graduates and for the Foreign Office. And I found myself in the Foreign Office, specializing in areas of the European Union on the multilateral side and then other aspects. And the rest is history.
Well, it's history and it isn't history. History lives, Francis. We're living it right now. But in your CV, describing it very generally, you suddenly find yourself working in a policy context in relation to 10 Downing Street, do you not?
That's right.
How does that happen?
I don't know. I think it was the 1990s. I think Labour had come into power after a long period of Conservative government. I think the peace process was moving forward at a rapid pace. The European dimension had a new sort of renaissance to it. Britain's foreign policy was continuing apace. And the Irish dimension and the whole focus on the peace process and reconciliation was a key part of, a priority for the British government, in particular for Tony Blair, who, I used to watch and I used to think, the amount of time a British Prime Minister is spending on this part of the world that I know really well, and every day, probably 3 hours a day he devoted to that issue over a 10-year period. And there were other voices at the time saying to him, the tradition in British politics had been, there's no votes in Northern Ireland, doesn't get you elected. Focus on education, focus on health, give up on this, and successive governments had parked it because it was just seen by a lot of people as intractable. And that there, I think, was just an amazing thing to watch because you were so steeped in it.
Were you brought in as at that point, I'm assuming, a relatively junior level civil servant because of your Irish background?
That I don't know. You come in, the Foreign Office always has about two or three staff members seconded from the diplomatic service into the Prime Minister's office. And in fact, we remain as two or three of them. Two of them have been here actually in Australia in recent months visiting. One of them was in the press office, and one of them is now in the Home Office. But at that time, the three of us were very close because we were from the same department. And you just have this intense experience of watching a new government and watching so many moving parts. I think, it's very difficult to work on something where you are emotionally connected. Mm. And where the conflict is, it's still going on and there were still issues. But what you're looking for is you're looking to see people doing the right thing. And I saw people at that time on all sides looking to do the right thing. And sometimes, we're in an age where people are very cynical about politicians and governments. And I will always remember with the deepest respect the people who got up every morning and devoted themselves to life and death issues year after year after year, and with the greatest degree of patience and serenity to basically try and grasp some aspect of peace. And that was writ large. And it's a sort of, it's an antidote to the cynicism that sometimes is there in public life about politicians or about people who volunteer to represent us. Because that there, for me, it couldn't get more real. It literally couldn't get more real that, my memory of school, was, you couldn't escape it in terms of whether you looked at the windows and you saw the towers in the distance. Would there be a checkpoint on the road by the army to come onto the school bus? Who would fall foul of an army patrol? It's just something that a conflict that permeated that particular point in time. And though we had taken it as normal, it wasn't normal. And then you see people moving on, where basically, again, I never thought I'd ever see the day that British prime ministers would apologize for the excesses and for the abuses that had taken place.
And there you are personally, sitting in a government context in London, watching prime ministers and others grappling with these various issues leading to those outcomes. It must have been an amazing time for you.
Yeah, it was, and it remains, because it was, if you were to offer me a chance at any period in my life where I would have had the chance to sit and observe and see this, that would have been it. Because it was a unique window, and you just sit with, as I say, and it's where you are. Are you more comfortable on the British side at that point in time? There are times where you're not. There are times where your heart is pulling you in a different direction. But I think as a diplomat or as a public servant, one of the things, whether it's in faith or whether it's in politics, is to try to sort of walk in the footsteps of the other. What do they see, rather than what do you see? And I think if you can put yourself in the perspective of the other person and try and see their worldview or world vision, it can be quite a difficult thing to do, but it can be fundamentally liberating.
It's really interesting to hear you use the language you've been using of peacemaking, of walking in the shoes of others, and some related comments. Is that something you think, as a person, you had naturally? Is it something they can teach you in the Foreign Office? Can they send you off to a self-help program in FCO and teach you to be a diplomat?
No. It didn't come from the Foreign Office. It didn't come from the Foreign Office. They may have added some training to it. It actually came from faith, because when you're growing up in a conflict that divides, or where violence is on the fray, and you have a sense of identifying people on the basis, of religion or national identity, and where people are losing their life or being injured, do you have some sort of, sympathy barometer that increases or decreases on the basis of whether you know this person or whether you don't, or whether they're that type of person or this type of person? And if it was a solely political environment where you're divided by national identity and there was no place for faith, but faith challenges you because faith drives into that space, checks what your human emotion or your human process is bringing you towards a division of someone, and reminds you or translates from something that might just be there in text, but is there is lived about the fundamental human dignity of another person, irrespective of their attribute. And that there is beginning to, when you get to know someone who is decidedly different from you. And I remember as a teenager meeting people who had been, they were now security guards working in London, but they had been squaddies who had been working in Northern Ireland. And I had never seen them in civilian clothes or in a normal environment. I'd only seen them with, you know, sort of camouflage uniforms and heavily armed and Land Rovers and Saracens. And that with other encounters, so you sort of come on a journey, and I think it helps you diplomatically to try to see, here is the same body of facts, but there's maybe seven different perspectives. So is it training? You do have some training in this regard, but I think the original impetus was that something in terms of the worldview didn't add up, and the sort of the faith dimension or the challenge of faith actually demanded just a different worldview as to what I was witnessing or where I might have felt more comfortable or more emotionally safe. Faith induced me to move out of that space and go in a slightly different direction.
You then come to work very closely with Tony Blair. What's the official description of your position when you take that up?
So I go in first to the policy unit as a policy advisor, and then I go into the private office as a private secretary. So always in the foreign policy side, foreign policy defence related areas.
So what does the private secretary do on a daily basis? You're covering these same big issues, but you're a bit closer to the PM.
You cover the same issues. You arrange briefing. You write papers. You take records. You follow up. You liaise with other Whitehall departments. You liaise with other centres of government across the world. You do a variety of things. You're basically part of a secretariat policy function for the Prime Minister.
And were there things that you learnt during that period that, as it turns out, have been useful,
yes,
beneficial to
yes,
you?
Yes, yes.
How would you list them?
Well, you see up close, you see, you know, you see people that normally you wouldn't see, and you see how they handle things, and you see different ministers, and you see different prime ministers, and you see people's ability to deal with, you know, a massive job and a massive amount of data and information, and how do they keep so many plates spinning, and how do they go from one thing to the other where they don't have time to drill down? So one of the key things is, you know, especially with the Prime Minister, is when do you stop drilling? You know, when do you, if you have so much information, when is the next, you know, if you're dealing with the NHS and you're moving from the NHS to an international crisis, and you're moving from the international crisis to the Northern Ireland peace process, there will be dossiers where you have to rely on the expertise around you. And I think the key art is around, you know, being able to keep all those various plates spinning. And the other thing is how people handle pressure. And in Tony Blair's case, I don't think I've ever seen anyone with a more sponge-like ability to absorb a huge amount of pressure and yet continuously be on form. That was really a really impressive skill set. And you know, you see different prime ministers over, or hear about different prime ministers over the years. And in her retirement, I regularly came across Mrs. Thatcher. She used to come out to Rome quite a bit. And again, people talked about her ability to be able to just absorb a huge amount of data and, you know, just keep going rather than be completely overwhelmed by the job. So that's one of the human things. And the other human thing you see is you see people with, you see them as, we tend to look at politicians, especially as very senior ministers, and we see them simply as like a public property or a piece of public property. They're in this role. But in a house like Downing Street, where the family are there as well, you see them as family people. You see them with a set of human connections. And first and foremost, it's these human connections. It's the second or third bit is the potential, is the office that they hold. Whereas I think, you know, we tend to see the office, but not the human being, and not, you know, that they're trying to do their best.
I've already mentioned, jumping slightly forward, that you finish up in Rome. You become an ambassador. You are dealing with whatever goes on in Rome. I can only begin to imagine people write racy novels about what goes on, on in the Vatican. Francis, we'll leave them for another.
I didn't.
We'll leave them for another day. But tell us briefly about being an ambassador to the Holy See. A lot of people would say, why on earth does anyone have an ambassador to the Holy See? What's the Pope got to do with this? And it's such a tiny little place, as pretty as it is, and Michelangelo did such a good job there. And what did you, after all of that, learn in that position?
So I think we had had a situation in the UK where a Catholic could not be ambassador to the Holy See.
What?
So the government, the Catholic Church in Britain, said this was, you know,
absurd.
Just something that had outlived, you know, contemporary history. So there was pressure to change it, so they changed it. And I found myself as the new ambassador to the Holy See. And it's a question, you know, it's a very good question around why in Britain's history, very fraught history with Rome. And including, you would say, going right up to, you know, the present in terms of, you know, some of the underpinnings of religious divisions in relation to Northern Ireland. It was there underpinning that in some extent, although it was never theological, but it just has an accident of history. Look, the Holy See is England's, or the Crown's, oldest diplomatic relationship. It was the very first one they established. And if you look at the 107 acres, yes, it's a microstate. But actually, our relationship is with the Holy See, which is the worldwide government. So it's a concept of sovereignty that is really similar to the Crown, but it touches 17.5% of the world's population.
Through the Catholic population.
Through the Catholic population. So you have, you know, a whole range of things that we were doing, which was around international development spending, the sheer, you know, spread of the Catholic Church as being the world's largest, you know, international provider of primary and secondary education and tertiary education. So, you know, somewhere around 70 million children a day going to Catholic schools. Health, you know, especially in the least developed parts of the world, it's often only, you know, the Catholic Church or the Anglican Church that are present on the ground. The environment and changing, you know, behavior around people seeing the environment and stewardship, even into areas of disarmament. And then areas where the domestic church touches. So 10% of British kids go to Catholic schools. You know, there's huge points of contact between the church and the state in Britain. Around 20% of Scotland's population is Catholic, nearly half the population of Northern Ireland, and 10% of England's population. And then the sort of the interwoven nature of England's and Scotland's history. So the fact that the Stuarts are buried, you know, the last Catholic royal family of Britain are buried in the crypt of St. Peter's. So it's just a sort of a historical trajectory there. And then a final element, which is the Holy See has been described, or the Vatican has been described by others, and we found it self-evident. It's one of the world's great listening posts.
Mm.
So, you know, if you think of a pre-Google or pre-sort of LinkedIn, you have something that is just one step removed or two steps removed from nearly everyone in the world. So there were enormous sort of occasions where if we wanted to know what was going on in a particular place and there wasn't the technical ability to know that, or the diplomatic network of the UK wasn't present on the ground, you certainly could find that a question could be answered.
Well, it sounds a little bit like a Graham Greene novel, the way you put
it. Parts of it could be, but I'm not going to get into that.
Now, you suddenly became famous in Northern Ireland towards the end of your tenure there. They made a television documentary about the day in life of the British ambassador to the Irish Sea, and you came to greater public notice than perhaps you had before. How did that come about? Did you enjoy it?
Well, it was the BBC approached, the Foreign Secretary was David Miliband at the time, and foreign ministries across the Western world have great difficulty, and I've always great sympathy with any diplomat in a Western country, because people have this perception of what diplomacy does or doesn't do for the country and taxpayers, why do we do this? So David had this idea that we should showcase back home to domestic audiences what actually an ambassador does. So I had a BBC crew with me covering about a year and a half.
Amazing.
And so it required very careful negotiation with the Foreign Office and the government, very careful negotiation with the Holy See. But it was a wonderful BBC crew put together, and they followed me for a year and a half. They produced a four-part documentary series. It culminated with the first state visit of a Pope to Britain in 2010. And it was really to illustrate, firstly, you know, what does life look like inside an embassy, but also maybe in a Northern Ireland context, the fact that, you know, for the rest of the world, a Catholic British ambassador probably doesn't, you know, mean the same thing. But I think at that particular time in our history, you know, a British ambassador who's Catholic to the Pope, there's probably a number of variables there that I could imagine the BBC were interested in.
Henry VIII was turning in his grave.
Yes.
There was an article I saw in relation to the documentary that espoused your capacities and your credentials and your diplomatic skills, and then said, what's going to happen next with this man? What did happen next?
Well, I went to Pakistan.
Yes.
And I had spent five wonderful years at the Holy See, and I went to Pakistan. At that time it was our largest diplomatic presence of in any country. It had eclipsed the US as the largest number of UK diplomats. The war in Afghanistan was going on, and again, within Pakistan, I'd worked before on interreligious dialogue in the post 9/11 world and the tensions there and the issues there. And again, within Pakistan, it's just a country that is, you know, has a huge diaspora for the UK, is a very, very strategic position. And for, you know, the whole link between the United Kingdom and South Asia is quite sensitive. And again, in Karachi and in Pakistan, it was just a very different diplomatic experience. But at the same time, still a society where religion and identity is still in flux and still in play, but yet with a different political type of landscape.
And continues to be like most parts of the world today, an enormous challenge. You're in a nice position now, Francis, where you can remain informed and think deeply about a lot of those places in the world where there are those tensions, but you've stepped out of it and you've found yourself in the world of academia. How did that come about? You first took up a position like your current one in London, did you not?
I did. I went, I had an approach from the university, and I went on, to explore it, and it was just something that, again, I didn't see coming, but actually, when you get to know more about it, I thought, why not? And I became vice chancellor of a new Catholic university in London, but it had been in existence as a college since the middle of the 19th century. It had a very strong Irish background for 100 years. It had been run by a religious order out of their province in Dublin. And I went there in 2014. And again, within education and linking education and what the transformative effect that education can have on a society, and bringing the world of practice into the lecture halls, I think that was really, a fantastic experience. There was a lot of people from different walks of life, whether it be law, business, government, the military, that came and became what in Australian terms would be professors of practice or adjuncts.
And now you're here in Fremantle, yes. Sydney and Broome.
Yes.
At least.
Yes. Yes.
And how did that come about?
Again, an approach. An approach from people that were employed here on behalf of the university, that were doing an international search. And my initial reaction was probably no. It's, but then something niggles, and it's always niggled in life around, well, why not? Don't say no as an initial reaction. Explore and then make an informed choice. And I explored, and I came here to Fremantle, I think around November 2018, for interviews, and then went to Sydney. And then took time to discern, had further contact. But what struck me was the story of the foundation. It started from scratch. It started from, encounters, conversations, collaborations, a group of people who wanted to do something. And then also the link to Notre Dame in Indiana. And I knew Notre Dame in Indiana quite well. And the commitment on the part of the people who were involved. So the zeal and the determination for the board, that they had a sort of a passion for the place. This was more than a board appointment that they had. And actually there was something alluring in that here was something that had started 30 years ago, that had started from scratch, that in other parts of the Western world, we're closing universities, but here they were opening, they were growing, they were spreading. And there's just something about the story of Notre Dame that was enticing and alluring, and the values that the size, it's not going for a growth model. The emphasis on the pastoral care for the students, the training for the professions, the link with medical schools, the link with nursing, the link with education and teaching. And they pulled at the right strings.
You didn't mention law there, did you?
Law's there as well. There's law, there's politics, there's international relations, there's a whole range, but I think both for here and also for St. Mary's, I'd spent 6 years at St. Mary's in London. And if you're in my position, you have benefited so much from Catholic education. You can see what it can do for a community. And in my community at home, it did so much.
Let's just talk about that for a moment. The idea of having a Catholic university, Notre Dame, albeit the links with Indiana and the like, was something new, certainly here in Western Australia, but generally in the Australian context, the idea of a private university. We had the Bond University, can't remember before or after, around about the same sort of time in Queensland. But what is it that a Catholic university seeks to bring to the community or the country, or beyond that?
So, it firstly, I think, it has to be a focus on the totality of how a human being is formed. So it's not simply, you can impart academic knowledge to someone, but without a moral framework or without a wider societal framework around a solid integrated formation, that can end up as being just purely vacuous. So I think there's a philosophy of education that firstly, you know, you may have this specialism in this discipline, but there is a T aspect of this. There's the horizontal and the vertical. There's the wider formation, and there's the invitation to come in and have this wider intellectual formation and human formation and spiritual and social. It's there in all its forms. So that's something that transcends boundaries. That's there. The second thing that's there is that, yes, it was new for Australia, but you already and still have a very vibrant primary and secondary faith-based education system. So 20% of the kids in Australia go to Catholic schools, and many others go to schools of other denominations. The tertiary level, again, like Britain, simply out of history, that hadn't been. There were teacher training colleges, but there weren't universities. The US has had a different trajectory, but out of the sort of the British system, of which Australia came out of that British and Irish system, it tended not to have the space. And I think a group of people here had discussions, and they thought, let's offer something that we see as distinctive. So, you know, I remember meeting the founding dean of nursing here in Fremantle, and she'd come out of the Royal Perth Hospital, and Peter Tannock gave her a complete free license to say, you design the school of nursing as you see, what's missing? And she said, what's missing is the students are not doing enough of practice. So to this day, we put a premium on the practical training, whether it's in education or whether it's in nursing or any of the other professional disciplines. Mm.
Everywhere in life, in religion, in politics, on the cricket field, some of those strange sports they play around Ireland, you've got conservative and progressive strands just to put tags on things. My impression is same in the Catholic Church as a broad system. Can universities be progressive or conservative? Is Notre Dame committed to any avenues that cause tags to be attached?
I would say no. I'm probably uncomfortable with tags like progressive and conservatism, because yes, they can be value laden. Because sometimes people who pursue what they think is a conservative position can actually be very radical.
Indeed.
So, I saw this in St. Mary's, and I see it here as well, that a huge amount of effort can be put into something which isn't core to an education mission. So in a sense, our task is to enable the individuals to have a formation where they can go out into the world and they can use their human agency based upon their intellect and their wisdom to discern what their path in life is. So for me, we are a university with a strong identity, which is religious. and our task, but that religious identity says something fundamental about the human person and about a Christian anthropology. But it's not trying to give somebody a slant in relation to something that they have to make a decision on. Our role is to, you know, give them a holistic education and formation to enable them to make the most of their life. So we try to avoid what you might describe as some of the paralysis of culture wars that can paralyze other organizations. It's not to say we don't have a worldview. We do have a worldview. You know, our tradition here is very much based upon, you know, the idea of a university in relation to John Henry Newman. It's Newmanesque. What does that mean? It talks about the universality of knowledge. It talks about an interdependence. It talks about a breadth of the human formation. It talks about creating people of wisdom and insight. So I think that for me is quite important, in that our focus remains a focus on higher education, and our contribution and impact on the world is through creating and forming sound, solid citizens. And you will find them in, you know, the Labour Party, you'll find them in the Liberal Party, you'll find them in the Nationals, you'll find them in NGOs, you'll find them in different walks of life.
In the diplomatic corps?
You'll find them, hopefully, in the diplomatic corps in Australia, and you'll find them. But it's an invitation, you know, that we see ourselves, when you're a Catholic university, it's different from being a Catholic school. You are, in many respects, much more out there in the society. You have academic freedom. You are inviting people in who are attracted because of what you are, but it's an invitation. You're being ambassadorial for the church and for society and for engagement. And it's an invitation, so it's publicly funded. It should be porous. It should be contributing to a plurality and a distinctive life of the church in Australia and of Australian society, and indeed internationally and regionally. So for me, that's the attraction of the Catholic university is something that is just grounded within a community and in a context, but which has that invitation constantly there for dialogue and engagement.
At a very practical level, I suspect in this COVID world, universities generally in this country have suffered. International students have been cut off. They're only now starting to dribble back. And you've also got an operation which is, as we've said, based here, Sydney, Broome. If I've missed anywhere, you'll tell me in a moment. But what's the future for Notre Dame as a growing or steady institution?
So we just launched our strategic plan for the next 4 years just a few months back, and we have made huge efforts in the last 2 years to solidify our national presence as a national university. But the global and the local, or the national and the local, should never be at odds with each other. But we are 12,000 students. We are spread across three sites, but more, because we have clinical schools in about six other locations, including in Melbourne. And our task is to create one university, but to make sure that it is locally based, because the way our students and staff encounter the university, they encounter it in each campus that they're in. Fremantle's our foundation. This is where we started. This is where we have our largest footprint. We then opened Broome, we then opened Sydney. Within our strategic plan, we have a huge emphasis on universality international. So going back to our foundation and re-establishing quite strong international links. Yes, to bring international students in, but also for our students and staff to go out. Also for joint appointments, also for dual degrees, joint research centres, and we already have some of our first joint appointments with other universities across the world. We have our first joint degree with the Catholic University of Paris. So we have 8 international law students here from Paris at the moment. So all of this is vitally important, but we're not aiming to be a volume provider. So there are universities in Australia that now exceed 60, 70,000 students. And that's good for them and appropriate for them. But our trajectory is not to simply go for volume. And we believe that would erode something of the distinctiveness which induced our foundation.
Just looking at Fremantle, that group of people who got together and had the vision for Notre Dame here, focused very much on Fremantle, acquired some lovely real estate here in Fremantle to create the university out of. It's amongst all these fabulous late 1890s gold rush buildings. It's in the West End. It's one heck of a place. How in a city as small as Fremantle and as distinct as Fremantle, with the sometimes slightly bolshy sort of citizenry that Fremantle has, does a Catholic university fit? Or does any university fit? How does a university become integrated with the place where it's situated?
I think, Michael, I'm smiling at this stage because I'm thinking you could easily be sitting in Oxford asking me the same question in terms of afterwards.
What came first in Oxford, probably, the university?
Yes, in terms of centuries of you know, even Durham has the same relations. Many of the universities of, you know,
yes,
what they describe as town and gown.
Yes.
And I think we're a little over 30 years in existence. And if we think just yesterday, for example, there was the blessing of the fleet, which sadly had to be cancelled.
Well, they blessed the fleet and they put up the crackers in
yes.
the sky. They
yes.
just didn't do the procession.
Yes, but we for the first time, it came down Mowat Street and the university had a role in that. And again, there is other, we're talking to the city, we're very keen as to how the university becomes more integrated and interdependent. I used the phrase earlier about a university being porous around, you know, art, culture, drama, theatre, talks. And I think as well about how do we revitalise the West End, especially in evenings and at the weekends, to make sure that there is a greater footfall through there. There is no problem in attracting students to Fremantle, international students, the space, the ambience, the environment is an absolute. It's got a, you know, when you talk to some of the people who founded the university, they traveled abroad, they went to Cambridge, they went to Leuven, they went to different places, and they said, we deliberately wanted not a greenfield site, we wanted an urban site for this university so that it was breathing in and through. And we have just completed a study on the contribution, an independent study on the contribution the university makes to the Fremantle economy in terms of employment, student footfall, what we support here. And it's freely available on our website. But it's sort of a starting point for us to say we are a presence here, we're a positive presence here. How do we work with others, with the city, with other similar bodies, for the betterment of the overall sort of built environment and broader environment within Fremantle, including the cultural environment. So that's there. I think where universities are present, they enrich the society, where they're engaged, where they're, you know, it's often universities are an attractive place in urban landscapes where people want to come. We have quite significant redevelopment and renewal restoration projects going on and planned, for example, for the Bateman Courtyard and the library. And again, it's around actually opening spaces up rather than closing them off and trying to create that sort of footfall for the wider community coming through as well.
Are there any grand projects for the next 5 or 10 years? Can we imagine how things, just staying with Notre Dame as an Australian entity, will look then? Will Sydney be bigger? Will Broome have done something different? Will Fremantle be the same?
So we have plans for all the, we've just finished sort of campus strategy plans for each of the sites, determining need, determining what we will do each year, determining renewal. We have the Customs House, which was bought here a number of years back, as to how will we redevelop that, what will we put in that. Other places like the library, then Prendeville Hall, what we do down Mowat Street. So our buildings require quite a lot of renewal. All universities have an impediment around student housing, especially for international students. And I think the city and the business community here in Fremantle is very keen to have more people living inside Fremantle. And again, you know, international students coming in, living in Fremantle, contributing to the local economy. So all sites, the Fremantle ecology is very different to what Broome requires, is very different to what Sydney requires. And I think having that degree of nuance in each place. But we do, we launched our plans, our strategic plan, just a few months back. We have an international pillar in there. We have a research pillar. We have educating for the common good. We have integrating knowledge and practice. And we have integral human development. And all those translate locally. So it's very much, we can't afford to stand still anywhere, because this is a very changing, it was rapidly changing before COVID. This huge amount of change and flux in the higher education landscape. And for us, you know, the easy thing we could do would be to try to sort of simply drift towards online provision alone. It will never be solely online for us. It will have to complement and blend. But for us, the philosophy of education has to be around that wider face-to-face formation and a presence in a community and a campus.
Francis Campbell, it's been delightful talking to you. Pleased you're here, and good luck with everything you're doing.
Thank you very much, Michael. Thank you.